Well, good morning. It's 11 o'clock on the button here at WFERLP South Royalton in Vermont. It's time for Green Zine on a Thursday. Henry Swayze joining me. Looking forward to a very interesting conversation with Tunbridge resident and biologist and National Park Service employee Aaron Weed. Starting off with a little Joni Mitchell with some Stardust, whether you're in Woodstock or not. Well, you were on Green Zine. We have some birds joining us this morning. We'll be talking about birds and a whole lot more with Aaron Weed in just a little bit. Henry joining me momentarily from the Queen City, looking for a new set of wheels. Green Zine is brought to you today by those moving panel solar folks down in Norwich, Solaflect. Also, Bale right here in town with a new leadership team helping out Chris Wood. You can find out more about them at balevt.org. Tom Wells and his fine company, Royal Trailworks. Daniel Leibowitz thinking about the Lone Wolf a little bit earlier today, playing some Jerry Jeff on the Elephant Stream. The Upper Pass Beer Company just saw Chris Perry heading up the road. Their four packs are available at most establishments, and they're on tap at Carlita's Cantina. First Branch Coffee Company right here on the Commons in South Royalton. Solarfest, more about Solarfest coming up maybe in the third of the show. The White River Land Collaborative just up the road a piece through the Howe Bridge, just across the Royalton-Tunbridge line, and a restaurant in Randolph that's going to have some live music this weekend, Wit and Grit. So let's let this song play. I think those of you may know the original version of this, but this is from the Pickin' on the Grateful Dead series. Hey, good morning. Henry, do you have this album at home?
No, I don't. I never got into being a Grateful Dead head, although I appreciate them more and more as I hear them in the rearview mirror.
Hey, I like that. You combined a visual with an audio thing there. You're hearing things in your rearview mirror. That's good, Henry. All right, I'm going to bring this down in the mix and welcome Henry Swayze. You're up there in the Queen City today?
I am, and winter is continuing on with its hiccups. doesn't know which way is up.
Yeah, interesting that if as far as a snowpack, I mean, we've had everything. You know, we get these little bits and dribs and drabs. Not much of it is melting because it's been so cold. But I understand up in the mountains and particularly up north, Northeast Kingdom, there was a 2-footer the other night of powder.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of variable depending on where you are. So they're having a real big winter up there. But we're cold here. At least we're cold.
Yeah, well, we're virtually bare ground in Burlington. It's a little bit white, but
okay.
You don't have to scratch very far before you find this grass underneath.
Gotcha. All right.
So should we get into, we start off with stardust. Should we do a little exploration how we're all made of stardust?
I think so. I dialed that up with only 2 minutes to go before the show when you mentioned you were going to talk about stardust. And, of course, in that classic song from Joni Mitchell called Woodstock, yeah, that we all come from stardust. Go for it, Henry.
So I got poking around one evening in things, and I decided I was going to have a look at how we're all made of stardust and how stardust is generated. And it turns out that when stars are formed, they're only made of hydrogen and helium, and maybe a tiny bit of something else, but they're basically those two lightest elements. And when they when the mass of the star draws itself together by gravitation, it gets hotter and hotter, and it ignites those into a thermonuclear event, and the star starts shining, and the star merrily goes along and gathers more heat and more mass, and those hydrogen and helium get torn apart and reformed and become heavier and heavier elements. But a star like the one that's our sun, which was not a supermassive star, just a modest garden variety star, it only has the ability, the center of that star has the heavier elements in it, and it only has the ability to get up about halfway on the atomic chart, up to about iron. And what will happen to our star is that as the hydrogen and helium get used up and converted into heavier elements, those heavier elements are not generating new heat. And so the star eventually will die, and it'll die in the form of a supernova. So it will blow up, and the outside shell with the remaining hydrogen and helium will get thrown away from the star, and the star will become very large. It'll be as big as Earth's orbit, but it's not going to happen tomorrow. They're talking maybe 5 billion years, so we have a little bit of time
to get ready.
Ahead of us. But our star doesn't make the stardust that is necessary for our existence. It only has, it's missing a bunch of things on the periodic table that are part of the human body. And so it turns out that when you have a star about forming that's about 10 times the size of our sun, that it goes through the same process. It's a very active star. It actually falls apart much earlier, fewer millennium than our sun, and it gets so dense in the center that that when it blows up, that blowing up forces all kinds of protons together, not electrons or neutrons, but protons, which are the things without any charge, and it makes the heavier elements. And there's actually a very small proportion of the stars do that, but they're the ones that are responsible for forming things like selenium and gold and the heavier elements on the chart, which are necessary for life. And that's then blown out into the universe and has a chance to travel everywhere and become stardust. And we get born of that. And then the other thing that happens is that process of being blown apart, what's left over in the core of that star is a black hole. It's so dense and so so has such intense gravity that that nothing can escape away from it, and it's basically just crammed together subatomic particles, and the black holes only get formed with those very large stars collapsing. And let's see, where do I go from there? That's probably enough 101 on
I'm not sure that was I'm not sure that was 101. That might have been more like 301, Henry. And I have a feeling you might be able to name every element on the periodic table.
No, I can't.
No,
so
okay.
In the notes for the show, there's a NOVA presentation link for a nice relaxed rendition of this, and then a link on the periodic table and how different things are important in the periodic table and where they come from. So if you want to dig further into this, you can.
Yeah.
But I up until having researched this, I was not aware that black holes were formed by the collapse of large stars. I didn't realize that that was sort of their own source. I thought they were some primordial thing that might have been created.
Well, I think I was aware of that part about that collapsing into this really condensed, what we call black hole. Hey, let's go from the cosmic and kind of bring it back down to Earth. Henry, I thought of some music. In fact, there's a piece you might hear in the future called Black Hole Sun. It might be from Pearl Jam, but that's for a future show. Give us just like a 30-second teaser about our guest, and then we're going to go to Bird Note.
Okay. So our guest is Aaron Weed, and he is with the National Forest, but he is at the Woodstock at the Billings
Farm National Park. Yep.
Yep. Yeah, Billings Farm National Park.
Yep.
Okay. Yeah, but it's a national, yeah, so he's not National Forest, he's National Parks.
Yep.
And he's going to get into the sounds of birds and how monitoring birds in the woods tells you about the what's going on there, not just the health of the bird population, but perhaps more than that. So we will get into that with him.
All right. Well, right now, it's winter. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead and do that bird note, and then if we have time, I'll go back and.
We might. Winter Brings Falcons, the latest bird note that just actually came out a couple of days ago. Let's take a listen and see what the falcons are up to here. You are listening to Green Zine at Royalton Community Radio.
This is Bird Note. Each season ushers in its own bounty of bird life. Winter is the best season to highlight North America's feathered thunderbolts, the falcons. Northern nesting species of falcons, like this peregrine we're hearing, move southward, closer to their many admiring observers. Hurtling through the air on blade-like wings, falcons rank among the fastest of all birds and the most adept at capturing prey in flight. One falcon much more prevalent across the U.S. in winter is the merlin. 10 inches tall with a 2-foot wingspan, the merlin chases down small birds from sparrows to sandpipers. Small but powerful, the fearless merlin will buzz even a huge eagle that enters its airspace. The majestic Jeer falcon drifts south in winter to the northern tier of states. Larger than a red-tailed hawk, in a direct sprint, the Jeer falcon can overtake even the fastest duck. The mid-sized peregrine falcon nests in some locales across the country, but its numbers are greatest in winter, especially near the coasts. During its dive on a hapless pigeon or dunlin, a peregrine may reach an airspeed approaching 200 miles an hour. For BirdNote, I'm Mary McCann.
Interesting as usual, Henry.
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating. They've done a really good job with the BirdNote's productions, and they're getting better and better at it. I frequently dip back into ones 2 and 3 and 4 years old. This is from this year. And the later ones tend to be a little bit better than the earliest ones. But so they're fine-tuning their game. I have just the California fires have been dominating the news cycle. And it's massive. And I got an email from the Post Carbon Institute, and I put a link or I put the information from this, what my email was from, in the show notes that I'll publish before the end of the show. And it says, I've felt a surge of sadness this past week while tracking the devastating wildfires in Los Angeles. I feel for all the people dealing with burned homes, health impacts, loss of life among friends and family. I'm rooting for the firefighters to stay safe when battling the blazes. I imagine fires are frightening and hard to take. Although I don't have unrealistic expectations, I'm hoping that this moment can bring a positive change, namely that people, especially those in powerful positions, will start treating climate emergency like a freaking emergency. And it goes on and says, this is an episode of Crazy Town podcast that was recorded a few months ago before the Southern California conflagration, but it addresses the need to take climate change much more seriously. And there's a link to that. Crazy Town. Crazy Town is produced out of spacing the name of the town, but California, where Caltech is, and so forth. And so it's, they're picking at all the disconnect we have between our actions and our realities. And, I don't know whether this, it certainly changes my attitude, and if we get to it in the third, I'll talk about some of the things that I'm going to do more religiously than I've done in the past.
Yeah, I look forward to that. Hey, we've got about a minute or so before we have Aaron join us. This is kind of related to what you were just doing there from Crazy Town. It's a letter to the editor from Neil Husher in Randolph listens to this radio station, but he was looking at the Herald last week. So the title of this letter is Can't Ignore Climate Change. And here's what Neil writes. An interesting juxtaposition found this past week in the Herald between the guest column, The Boneyard, Watching Water Eat the Coast Away, and the letter to the editor, Republicans Hear Loud and Clear, by Senator Scott Beck, who is from St. Johnsbury. One tells the story of alarming beach sand erosion and the huge cost to replenish it per mile in an increasingly losing battle with global warming to save it, and I would add the expensive salt marsh behind it. Goes on to say, an exercise. Go on Google Maps and fly down the east coastline. A modest sea level rise and the barrier islands are gone, and the protections they provide for the mainland. Even Mr. Musk hasn't the money to save them. Envision what happens to all of the salt marshes along the East Coast. There's no place for them to back up into. The other, a letter, a tired, and this is Neil Husher's word, do-nothing Republican jingle with the same old whining excuse. Why should, quote, we solve the world climate change in a small, cold climate state? The fact is, Vermont is number two per capita in greenhouse gas emissions in New England. Kind of embarrassing. No, Vermont is not going to solve the global problem on its own, but I think we should at least do our part. Yes, it will cost. So does it cost to repair the flood damage last year to Senator Beck's constituents in the Northeast Kingdom, a cost that we will all bear to a degree? And the years of flood damage is before that and the many years to come. Perhaps Senator Beck, instead of spending his time on the lame Republican jingles, could instead engage his creative mind to solve problems so that Vermont may then aspire to be number three. So,
that's right on target.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's go back to something more pleasant, like
birds
like birds and their value in the ecosystem, because I think it's nature that has the best chance to actually turn things around if we'll just work with it.
All right.
So, Aaron, are you there? And welcome to Green Zine.
I am here. Can you guys hear me?
Oh, loud and clear.
We can.
Aaron, and you
are you? Well, yep. Greetings from Woodstock.
Yeah, well, yeah. Hey, that was a double tie-in with that song earlier. down in a different Woodstock. Hey, Aaron, good to talk to you, and I'm glad that we lined you up. And, of course, you're going to be giving a talk tomorrow night, so the timing is great for this.
Yeah, thanks so much for the invitation and opportunity.
So Aaron, maybe just to put your life in perspective, I see you have a PhD, and you are focused, at least in part, focused on birds and their roles in our ecosystem. And I wonder if you could just tell us kind of how you got to where you are. What was your path that got you to Woodstock? quick elevator version of it.
Yeah, I'll try to be brief, and I'll also be completely honest that I'm actually trained as an entomologist and not an ornithologist, but during that path, I've studied a lot of populations and so forth of insects, mostly related to climate change and forestry and also management of invasive plant populations. And then when I started with the Park Service, so I was doing all of that work as a postdoctoral research associate at Dartmouth and other positions before that. When I started with the Park Service 10 years ago, I started working on broader monitoring programs, which is how I got more introduced and started working on birds in particular, as well as forest vegetation and water quality. So a lot of my interests have always been about what are things and why do populations change and what are the factors in the environment, et cetera, that influence those populations. And I've been able to bring that to the National Park Service program, where I manage a wonderful team. Some of us are based here in Woodstock. A few of us are based down in Acadia National Park, where we're doing broad-scale, more or less ecosystem monitoring within 13 parks in the Northeast, ranging down, starting up in Acadia National Park, going all the way through a number of Revolutionary War parks like Saratoga Battlefield, and then ending in the South in Morristown, New Jersey. We also have the distinction of being able to work with partners at the Appalachian Trail, which is also another Park Service unit, on some of their monitoring.
Yeah, I noticed that when I looked up the New England Temperance Network. That's quite a collection of places that you guys check out. And then I saw at the end of it that the entire Appalachian Trail. Boy, that's a lot of work there, Aaron.
Yes, and we accomplish this work through just a vast number of really awesome partners, nonprofits, as well as academic and other scientific organizations. And we couldn't do it without those folks. And we work across scale with a lot of our Park Service units. So not to go into all of the details, but I'm a regional scientist, and I happen to be based at Marsh Billings Rockefeller National Historical Park, which is across the street from Billings Farm, and our team services this area of parks. So it's a lot of fun. And as I said, the work, you know, being able to work with so many partners on these really important issues is really, really gratifying.
Mm-hmm. So if you have to measure the health of an area, the biological health, I guess you can attack it, as you've said, from a lot of different directions. You can look at the insect population. You can look at how clean the water is that's coming off the land. You can listen to the birds and identify the bird population. Is one of those, or some other one that I haven't thought of, more powerful than others in getting the job done, in figuring out what the health of the land is and what can be done to improve it?
It's a really great question, and it's also a hard one. The way that we've addressed that, because we have appropriated funding from Congress, and those budgets have been flat for many years now, is we have to decide on a certain number of candidate metrics. So we call vital signs of these ecosystems. Yeah. And because most of the parks in my network contain temperate upland forests, a lot of our primary programs are focused on those vital signs related to forest vegetation. So we have a team that measures everything from the top of the canopy of the trees all the way to the understory herbs and regeneration of trees. And that's actually turned out to be a very important part of an issue that's happening across a lot of our parks. A lot of regeneration that we're not seeing in certain areas, et cetera. Within that program, or as a complement to it, we do our forest bird program, where we do monitoring within 9 parks, looking at the status and trends of the forest bird community, and then we look at some grassland birds and Saratoga. We also are monitoring water quality and water quantity so that we can look at how increasing levels of precipitation and other factors such as land use may be influencing the water quality within those areas. With the exception of Acadia National Park, most of our parks don't manage the entire watershed, and so we use that monitoring to help inform where potential stressors are, whether that's agricultural runoff, et cetera, et cetera. And then we have Acadia National Park and the Boston Harbor Islands have upland forests, but they also have coastal ecosystems. And so we do have some vital signs monitoring that are catered to those that we work with other partners on. And those involved in Acadia, we look at intertidal habitat monitoring because that's actually changing quite rapidly. The Gulf of Maine, water temperatures are increasing quite a bit. Ocean acidification are issues, but also a lot of the visitors of the millions of visitors that go to Acadia National Park, they're visiting the intertidal. And then in Boston Harbor, in another program that I'll talk about tomorrow or for the winter evenings, is our coastal bird monitoring that we've been doing with Mass Audubon Coastal Bird Program, as well as a number of other state agencies looking at the long-term patterns of colonial nesting birds there. So it's kind of a mixed bag of the approaches that we have. But in general, those that I listed, we feel pretty strongly are the important vital signs, but there's always room to do more. It's that balance of budget and so forth too.
Yeah. Hey, I've got a question about the coastal birds. I know you're going to talk about it more tomorrow night, and I'm looking forward to being there. So during your 10-year tour down there at Marsh Billingsley with the National Park Service, have you noticed a trend in what's happening with the birds? Is it a change in total number of birds or in types of birds? Or what can you give us a teaser about that?
Yeah, it's a great question. So it really depends on. So we have about 10 species that we've been monitoring, and these are relatively large, colonial nesting species. So think about double-crested cormorants. There's a couple species of gulls that we monitor. Common eider, which is at its southern distribution in the Boston Harbor Islands in terms of breeding, and a variety of wading bird species or herons such as glossy ibis and snowy egret and so forth. I would say that what's also interesting is the Boston Harbor Islands, it's an archipelago of islands and which vary in their quality and the type of habitat they have for the nesting to support these birds. And the other interesting dynamic is that this is across a very mixed multi-landowners, you know, different towns are owning and managing different parts of the islands. And so to answer your question, Todd, what we're seeing is that some of our more common species like double-crested cormorants are actually very stable in terms of across the entire park and the islands. But we have seen over the past few decades some pretty remarkable declines in the wading bird populations. And we're still in the process of trying to figure that out. And I actually just last week was working on a proposal with these partners to try to get into more investigation in that. But they have very clear and restricted nesting requirements, such as in trees and shrubs. And we're looking a little bit more into see whether their foraging habitats are also been impacted, because things like sea level rise, wave exposure, these are impacting these marshes in a variety of ways. The last thing I'll mention is really, you know, wonky-looking bird, American oyster catcher. For those who are familiar, that's actually just has been recolonizing the islands after presumably being extirpated by, you know, colonization by the Europeans, you know, years and years ago. And so that species is a beach nester and has, you know, it's increasing in the islands in general. And it seems to be expanding its range northward, presumably due to climate change. But because it's a beach nester, think about like a loon or these other species that are right on that edge of the water. Wave action, storms from sea level rise and other, you know, climate change related phenomena are really impacting its ability to successfully breed. So they will lay a clutch of eggs. Predators are also an issue, but untimely storm surges can actually prevent them from being able to produce young.
Hmm. Wow. So, can you generalize about the resiliency and the health of the ecosystem, just kind of where those things feed on each other and kind of what's important to do to support more resiliency?
Yeah, it's a great question. If I kind of come back to our local, you know, temperate northern hardwood forest habitat and some of the results of our monitoring. So we have basically found across a lot of our parks, and Marsh Billings and Acadia and St. Gaudens are exceptions more or less to that rule, but south of us, we're seeing really drastic reductions in the replacement of native tree canopy species in the understory, primarily due to invasive plants, but also due to overabundant deer. And we're having issues with pests such as emerald ash borer coming in and disturbing the canopy, and what comes back are invasive shrubs, honeysuckle and some of these other species that are just
buckthorn.
A real bear to deal with, and buckthorn. And they prevent regeneration of new trees. So we have a big program that's really been started by my ecologist, Kate Miller, who called the Resilient Forest Initiative, where we're really working with our parks to restore understory, midstory layering, and native canopies within these parks, because those are important for the functions of these, for not only the continuity of forest cover. You need little trees and mid-sized trees to replace the large ones when they eventually die. But that also provides habitat, important habitat for birds, as we know, that some of the species are nesting on the ground, some of them are nesting in mid-story and then the canopies, but they're also, that layering is important for the insect fauna that they feed upon to provision their young, for example. So we're looking at resiliency as a way of not only promoting more diverse forests in terms of species. We want a good number of species to be there, but also the different structural aspects of the forest itself.
So we recently had Zach Porter on from Standing Trees, and they just did a rally this last Saturday. That Todd was at, and they are arguing for having older growth trees be protected. And I'm wondering whether you, in your work, interact at all or have any weight with the National Forest's approach to be so highly focused on board foot wood production instead of environmental diversity.
So it kind of comes back to the mission of the Park Service and the Forest Service are very different, and the national park units across the U.S., and this varies to some degree based on whether you're a wilderness habitat or not, but we have the highest degree of protection and, you know, of habitats within our parks. You know, and so what that has culminated in, based on our monitoring, is that our parks across the Northeast, as compared to outside of our park boundaries, we have more mature forest. We have more mature forest structure, which means that we have larger trees, we have larger volume of dead woody debris, which gives all sorts of habitat for these animals and so forth. In general, on average, are those statistics, if you look at it across the board with our parks, and we have some papers on this on the literature as well, we are more diverse because of that mandate. My sense is that the Forest Service is actually becoming a little, you know, versus managing just for board feet, they have much more of a mixed and diverse management directive now. That incorporates wildlife habitat, which is really great. But for the purposes of, I guess, answering your question, we do have we have historically had very different management regimes, which have resulted in different, you know, forest structure to some degree.
Right.
That being said, you know, in the western U.S., thinning out forests to provide forest fire protection or protection from bark beetles and those types of things is being done in national parks because we understand these are, you know, if our administrative boundaries are connected to our partners and other, you know, neighbors, then, you know, we need to manage those things together. And that tends to be a big deal out west as compared to here.
Do you think, as right. far as possibly sharing information, and I completely understand how the mission statements between the Forest Service and national parks would be very different. Do you think there's, you know, is one agency kind of keeping an eye on the other and maybe learning and the other way around? Or are you guys really pretty separate and not in any kind of advisory role?
No, there is definitely collaboration there, Todd. It's a good question. We work with the Forest Service a lot on helping us with pest suppression and understanding the impacts of, like, invasive of pests and hemlock woolly adelgid, southern pine beetle, all of these, well, which has moved up north because of climate change is native, but and then emerald ash borer. These are some big species issues that, you know, some of our parks have been working with for years to help on pest suppression and understanding. And I would definitely think, and I think the examples are probably a little bit more prominent out west because a lot of the parks back to national forests, there's much more coordination. And what comes to mind are like spotted owl monitoring and other kind of habitat management like that. So, yes, I think that it happens. And I think more and more, you know, these are getting, you know, it's getting better and better. The one example I'll give you a little bit closer to home is on the Appalachian Trail. As I mentioned, the Appalachian Trail is a National Park Service unit, but it's managed, co-managed through a variety of agreements and partnerships with folks like the Appalachian Mountain Club, the Appalachian Trail Conservancy. But the National Forest Program is a huge partner of theirs, and they work together for protecting land and conserving it and to meet, you know, mutual needs with, you know, ecological benefits being one of those.
Hmm.
So you gave us some bird sounds to share. Do you want to get into that before we?
Yeah. So, yeah, no, happy to. Sorry if I cut you off there.
No, not at all.
Go ahead, Todd.
I was just going to say, tell us what go ahead. But as far as this clip, where it was recorded, what, and then maybe afterwards you can tell us what you're hearing there, because we're going to hear a lot going on in this clip when we start it.
Yeah, the clip that I shared was collected by me from some sound recordings that we took at Marsh Billings Rockefeller, I think back in 2022. This is at one of our long-term bird monitoring points sites that we have historically been monitoring with people. And this is a program that I just want to acknowledge was actually developed by Steve Fascio back in the early 2000s and with Vermont Center of Eco Studies. Mm. It's been a long-term partner with this. And we're using sound recorders to supplement some of the volunteers, the hundreds of volunteers that we've used over the years, not just at Marsh Billings, but across the network, to improve our ability to monitor the populations in the communities of birds within our parks.
Wow. And we are very familiar with Steve Fascio and the Vermont Center of Eco Studies. I think Steve's been a guest on this show. So great that you guys are all working together. So why don't we play this clip, and then we'll have some reflections on what we heard. You are listening to Green Zine with Aaron Weed and Henry Swayze and myself, Todd Tyson, on Royalton Community Radio. There you have it.
Yes, thank you. That was the dawn chorus. That was probably, I think I remember that snippet was from probably about 5 a.m. In the western part of the park here in Woodstock.
Wow. Yeah, that was quite the chorus. Henry probably picked out a number of those birds that were joining the chorus.
Well, actually on the phone, they're really, really hard to figure out what I'm hearing.
But you heard him yesterday when Aaron sent you that clip. Come on.
So Aaron, how much diversity does that represent? Do you have any sense of how many different birds we heard there?
I mean, we're definitely hearing some robins. We're hearing some thrushes, certainly some red-eyed vireos there and oven birds in the background, too. Generally at the park, and I should pull up the statistics so I don't misquote here, but we're seeing in Marsh Billings anyway, we're seeing a consistent number of somewhere around 40 to 50 species that are breeding here in the forests each year. Now, that doesn't mean that's all of the species that we see here that migrate through and or that are occasionally passing through in the winter, but these are the ones that we are consistently picking up in our monitoring program that we believe to be breeding within the park and provisioning their young here specifically. And this includes a variety of our resident species like black-capped chickadees and some of the woodpeckers, as well as a lot of the neotropical migrating species such as warblers. The reason I wanted to share that, because that soundscape to me is just so wonderful and filled, but it's also makes it a little bit of, it's just, we have our bird monitors go out there and it shows you the immense complexity of sound that they have to kind of consider when they're doing this monitoring. And part of that is because 90% or more of the detections that we have of the species at these sites are all through audio detection. We don't actually see the males calling. We actually are just hearing them. So that's one component of it. The other reason I wanted to share that was we are, as I mentioned, we work, our bread and butter is monitoring animals and plants and trying to find ways to improve that. And we're currently working with some partners at Dartmouth College and the Cornell Lab of Ornithology to really implement the acoustic recording, sound recording into our monitoring program, so that will improve our ability to detect trends for and increase the certainty around those trends of individual species or those communities. Yeah. And just to be super clear about that is, there are situations where when we're out in the park, we're trying to understand how many species are there, and sometimes those species don't call when we're actually there for that 10-minute what's called a point count. By putting in recorders, having them record from around 5 a.m. to 10 a.m., and they're recording from about 7 to 8:30 p.m., we're getting not only multiple samples, if you will, of the bird population community in the morning, but also kind of at night, which greatly exceeds the number of samples we get from one person visiting that site, usually just once per year for 10 minutes. And so the acoustic recorders allow us to just get more information about what species are there. You know, so that's one component of it. The other thing is that we're working with some of these academic partners because acoustic data, not only to measure the soundscape, but to analyze for individual calls of species, can be very laborious and almost unfeasible to maintain, you know, over the long run. And so we're working with these partners to actually improve programs. Think about Merlin, if everybody knows that app that you can get.
I love it.
Yeah, Merlin Super. We're working with the Cornell Lab on their research version of that, which is called BirdNet, to retrain that so that it gets better and better in our parks, so that it can pick those individual species out of that cacophony of song. Mm. And we've seen some really remarkable results by a PhD student, Pooja Pamwar at Dartmouth, working with my colleague Matt Ayers there. And our cooperator, Laurel Symes, at Cornell Lab, where we're basically looking at how we're comparing the success that the recorders and essentially the artificial intelligence models are able to pull out those species as compared to the diversity that the human observers have done there. And we've seen that they are supplementing and doing a great job together. And so this really feels like moving forward, we can add recorders to kind of fill in the gaps for where we can't get volunteers and other people, and also to just supplement that kind of information that's coming in.
Yeah, I guess that those sound recordings have been used, dropped into really remote areas like in the Amazon and so forth, and have been used for effectively monitoring the health of the forest there.
It's a technology being used worldwide to conserve elephants, rhinos, all sorts of stuff across the world. It's being really, really important. And we see it as an ability just, again, not only for more engagement and understanding, and it does open up a variety of ecological and evolutionary questions that I won't get into, that's beyond just the population monitoring and just to have that information.
Yeah. Wow.
Well, you might not get into those other subjects today, Aaron, but you've opened up a whole lot of doors to some other things. So I have a feeling we're going to, maybe in a year's time, maybe we'll get you back here on Green Scene. And really looking forward to your presentation tomorrow night. My partner supplied me with a lot of background information, but I'm just going to give a short snippet here before we go. Tomorrow night at the Tunbridge Public Library, the gentleman you've been listening to for the last half hour, Aaron Weed, will be presenting, and the name now I'm skipping around to find out where it is here. The title of your talk, Bird Monitoring in Our Local National Parks, and you'll be talking a lot about the Northeast Temperate Inventory and Monitoring Program for the National Park Service, all getting underway at 7 o'clock tomorrow night. At least you don't have to commute very far for that, Aaron.
Yeah, no, it's a really nice, convenient ride down the hill. So
yeah.
Looking forward to seeing you all there.
All right, excellent. Aaron Weed joining us from Tunbridge and also from Marsh Billings down in Woodstock. Looking forward to your presentation. Really, really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much, Henry and Todd. I really appreciate the opportunity. Nice to talk with you.
Thank you.
All right.
Great to have you on.
Got a little music here, Henry. You know that Aaron mentioned that he was into insects. He's an entomologist, so let's let this go from Fiddlin' John Carson for just a little bit here on Green Zine. That's Fiddlin' John Carson from the late 20s, Ain't No Bugs On Me. And this time of year, not too many bugs around, Henry. Hey, thanks for rounding up Aaron for that presentation. That was great. Really enjoyed it.
Excellent. Well, thank you for pointing out his upcoming, so that at the Tunbridge Library.
Tunbridge Library. It's being put on. It's part of a series at the Tunbridge Conservation Commission. In fact, it's the first of a three-part series, so we'll have more to talk about. Actually, we're going to be talking a little bit later. We might have an interview with, I think her name is Emily Ruff from the Sage Mountain Herb. Anyway, that'll be next month, but it is tomorrow night. I would arrive early. I have a feeling there are going to be a lot of people at the Tunbridge Public Library when it gets underway at 7 o'clock.
7 o'clock. Okay.
Yep.
Right there, right on Route 110.
Can't miss it. Got a nice paint job on the outside, too. Yeah.
So, can I comment on my kind of New Year's resolution here?
I think you've got some information on, I don't know if it's about carbon credits, but you're making a little trip. Does this have to do with your trip that's coming up?
Well, yeah, I'm going to go out to the West Coast. I seem to try to get out there once a year. It doesn't always happen. But I try not to fly very often because flying generates a lot of carbon trail. And I found my climate, which is a link in our notes to that will be, and it's a calculator that allows you to figure out what your emissions are, and they're one for flying. You can get very sophisticated with it. You can put in your departure airport and your where you're flying to, and whether you're making any stops, and what the planes are you're flying on, and it will calculate your pounds of CO2 that you put in the atmosphere. And they also have it for driving and for all other living, things you might be doing in your life, your home, and so forth. And my big ones are the ones I pay attention to, which is driving and flying and household heat, I would say. Those are the big ones for me. It turns out to fly from Burlington to Seattle and back that if we were to take $100 a ton as a price point for CO2 emissions, which is probably a high enough price point to change behavior, but not really the true cost of the carbon emitted. The true cost, we may do a show on that in the future. It might be as high as 8 or 10 times that high. If you really look at all of the environmental impact, increases in human health concerns, and now we're seeing all the destruction from wildfires and things being caused by it. And when you start including those costs, it probably will be $100 a ton will be cheap. But turns out that that for every gallon of gas you put in your gas tank and every dollar you pay for an airline ticket, least flying economy, if you were flying first class, I think it would ratchet it up quite a lot. But, of course, your price is ratcheted up, too. About a third of that, if you were to take a third of that and that price, dollar for gasoline, and in my case, it was West Coast trip, about $130 for flying to the West Coast. And what I have done before, but I've only done it for this airplane trip. I haven't done it for my gas mileage and my other carbon footprint activities. And I'm going to actually track this, and I'm going to be sure that I've given that much money to things that I think are having the biggest impact on climate change, the things that are curing it the best. I've frequently given to the Environmental Defense Fund because I think they are doing a lot of good work. So I'm not buying carbon offsets. I'm just going to give that money to organizations and situations that I think are making, having the biggest impact on changing, reversing warming in our world.
I like it, Henry.
So that's my New Year's resolution to do that. And as I say, it's rewarding to feel as though you're helpless in changing all this. I think that really does move it up into, okay, well, I didn't cure it, but I certainly helped.
Hey, here's my brief EV story. I've got endless EV stories. But yesterday, we do have chargers down below the studio here in South Royalton that the law school, Vermont Law and Graduate School, operates. And sometimes they're working really well, and sometimes they're not. And I got back, and I was charging my vehicle down there, and there was a gentleman who was clearly having trouble getting his app to work. And I was going to unplug, and my partner said, well, why don't you help that guy out? I said, well, I guess I could. So I got out my card, which you can also use to activate the charger, and boom, got him, just took the plug out of my vehicle, put it back into the stanchion, used the card, put it in, and you want to see a smile on that face when it turned from green to blue. Blue's a good color, by the way, when it lights up on your EV. So when you're looking for an EV there, Henry, watch the colors as well.
So tell me what blue means.
That means it's fully connected and it is charging, at least for this particular charger. Now, there's a whole lot of chargers out there. Hey, I do have a standing trees update. I'm kind of checking the time because I want to bring the bird song back up because we're not done with the birds yet. We're going to rejoin this piece. It's based on the song, Bird Song, that Robert Hunter and Jerry Garcia put together a long, long time ago. So, as you mentioned earlier, my partner and I were at the Standing Trees rally, and there's a little, and the press was there, the Rutland Herald, I think WCAX-TV out of Burlington was there, and here's a little note from Standing Trees. Approximately 100 people gathered last Saturday outside the Forest Supervisor's Office in Mendon to protest the Telephone Gap Integrated Resource Project logging proposal by the Green Mountain National Forest folks. Forest Service, after years of planning, had chosen to move forward one of options they had identified. Standing Trees, who we talked with Zach Porter, has been opposed to this logging, particularly in older, mature sections of public land, organized the protest. And there's some links here. As reported by the Rutland Herald, Standing Trees' Zach Porter stated that the Forest Service has a broken and outdated system to make decisions. The forest plan doesn't deal with climate change, and the plan would needlessly cut some of the rarest types of growth in Vermont. This project affects areas in Chittenden, Killington, Mendon, Pittsfield, Brandon, Goshen, Pittsford, and Stockbridge under the oversight of the Rochester and Middlebury Ranger Districts. I want to thank all of the listeners to Green Zine and the public for calling in with their comments, and also to their federal delegations. This round of feedback has closed, and we'll give you an update Real quick, our underwriters here as the birds start to fly away. Here on Green Scene at WFVR-LP, South Royalton have been Solaflect, Bail, Royal Trail Works, Daniel Leibowitz, the Upper Pass Beer Company, First Branch Coffee Company, Solar Fest, White Riverland Collaborative, and Wit and Grit. Henry, anybody online for next week? Got 10 seconds.
No, we're still fishing for someone for next week.
Okay.
We had someone lined up, but he's got to do it later.
All right.